Good evening, Octane Addicts. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, or on www.archive.org, and now on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Amazon. Our live audience numbers are impressive, but the number of downloads from the archive library is mind-boggling. Please check out the Racing History Project website to see what you've missed. Okay, there's a place in France that hosts the craziest spectacle in motor racing. American racers have aspired to compete there for the past 60 years or so, and then come home wondering why they put themselves through a Stygian test of determination, finance and logistics, mental and physical stress, and bureaucratic and nationalistic abuse. But each one of them would do it again in a heartbeat. Every IMSA driver knows this. Some have been successful there. Some have been bashed repeatedly. For some, once is enough, but it was worth it. Our guests tonight have heeded the siren's call to cross the sticks with their teams and cars crammed in the boat. In alphabetical order, tonight we have Doc Bundy, Burt Greenwood, Mark Hutchins, Ben Keating, Jeff Klein, and Rick K. Noop. Doc Bundy raced at Le Mans at least three times, driving a Group 44 Jag in 82, a 925 Carrera in 84, and a Panos Esperante in 97. He never finished in the Big Bunny, but he came home with great memories. Burt Greenwood, where did I write that down? Raced in 72, 73 in a BFG Corvette, and in 76 in the wide-body Spirit of Le Mans Corvette with his brother John. Mark Hutchins drove a Z&W Team RX-7 in 1980 and finished 21st overall with Ernesto Soto. Cool driver. Mark Hutchins, yes, you. Ben Keating has raced at Le Mans every year since 2015 with two wins out of four podium finishes. Other gears weren't so happy. He has driven everything imaginable around that circuit. He won his class this year in a TF Sport Aston Martin AMR. Jeff Klein drove a Walkinshaw silk cut Jag in 1989 and DNF'd in the race in which only 19 cars finished. Rick Noop first came to Le Mans when he was a wee lad in 1978 and drove an Amdahl Kramer 935, finishing sixth overall with Jim Busby and Chris Cord. In 1984, he came in 12th overall in the lovely BF Goodrich Mazda Lola T616. Okay, boys, we have a lot to talk about. So, dear audience members, please mute your phones. If you have a question, just send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. Okay, here's my first one. Everybody I've asked has had a different story about how they got into the Le Mans race. How about you? Was it based on who you knew, your racing record, or your bank account? How difficult was it in the years before email? How did y'all get into Le Mans?
Do you want to do it in alphabetical order?
Nah.
No?
If you have a burning desire to speak first, by all means, do it.
Well, okay. I guess I'll go first. Mark Hutchins here, 1980. I got there because I was hired by Z&W to build the car. So we started with a stock off the showroom RX-7, and I towed it down to Holman Moody and spent 6 months converting it into a GTU car. And then we ran Daytona and finished third in class with a two-hour engine replacement during the race, so we would have finished
probably
pretty high up. And Sebring, we DNF'd. Walt Bourne was co-driving, and the rear axle you know, failed for some reason. I think it's because of the lubricant we were trying to use. And then we packed everything up and went to Europe and did Silverstone, which I guess we won our class technically. We were based at Walkinshaw's shop in Kidlington, and ran, you know, the car ran like a train. And then we went to the Nürburgring and DNF'd from a technical error I made, a language problem. And then we went to Le Mans and started 54th. Probably would not have qualified due to, the, you know, 280 horsepower is not very much. And then I think the next car had 400 or 500, so we were a little bit behind the power thing. But it rained in qualifying, and I had was able to get a lap, and that was close enough. So we started 54th, ran like a train till the end, and wound up finishing 7th in IMSA, which was a stupid class to put us in because we were driving a GTU car against 935. So, you know, go figure. But anyway, the car ran to the end, and I was pleased for having – you know, designed and built all the electrical and fuel stuff and all that kind of thing. So I was happy personally that I was able for my first car out of the box to make it so reliable. That was my focus on, was on reliability. Driving at Le Mans, I mean, I don't know if everyone will agree, it's a relatively, I think, easy circuit. We drove it with three drivers, so it was one or two stints, so it's not bad. The temperature was fine. It's not like Sebring where it's really hot. Yeah, so I'm not sure what else to say. It ran good, and we didn't have any trouble, and everybody stayed on the pavement and tried to stay out of trouble. So,
yeah, Mark, we got a question here from the audience.
Yeah, go ahead.
What was it like to be going down the Mulsanne Strait long before they put the kink in it? At however fast you were going, being passed by guys going 100 miles an hour faster.
Yeah, it sucked pretty much. But
and that
it was
question
good.
Ought to be asked of everybody.
It was good to not have – I'm not a fan of chicanes. So it was fine just to drive down the straightaway, you know, just to drive down the Mulsanne without having to do a chicane. So I didn't – I thought that was fine. In terms of looking out for other traffic – that was a big deal, you know, to be keeping your eyes in the mirror and looking for someone to go by. And I think we would signal which side we wanted people to pass on, which was usually on the right side. On the straightaway, we would go down the left, and they would pass on the right, as I recall. So, yeah, it wasn't great being so slow.
No, it wouldn't be. But
yeah, but, you know, it was
still
a
major thrill, though, yeah.
I mean, it was the best we could do, and for me, it was just it was a job that I evolved into from starting at Bill Scott Racing, which is a Formula Super V team, you know, sweeping the floor. So for me, it was a relatively large step, you know, in my so-called career. But yeah, it wasn't easy.
I'm glad you got to do it, though.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was a lot of work. You know, between Silverstone, Nürburgring, and Le Mans, it was, we just had our heads down, and, you know, all the hoopla had really nothing to do with us. It was just work,
right.
work, and then hop in the car.
I think a lot of people could say that. You don't get to be a tourist while you're there.
No.
Now,
how about somebody?
That same question. Ben, did you drive there prior to them putting that chink in the chicane in, or only afterwards?
Who are you asking?
Yeah, Ben Keating.
I,
okay, Ben.
Yes, so this is Ben Keating, and I don't know when they put the kink in, but I've only ever driven at Le Mans with the two chicanes on the Mulsanne Strait. And I guess I'll use that entry to answer the question for myself. You know, first and foremost, I am a car dealer, and you know, I got my start racing in a Viper. I was the number one volume Viper retailer in the world, and so I had a big connection to that brand. I raced in their spec series class, and I was instrumental in convincing them to build a GT3 car for me to go into the newly combined, you know, United Sports Car Series in 2014 when Grand Am and ALMS combined. And so, you know, I was racing a Viper for Bill Riley, who was running the factory program. So I was running the Pro-Am car in amongst and with the factory effort. And when they went to Le Mans with the factory GTE Vipers in 2014, I went as a spectator just because of my connection with the team. And then, lo and behold, to all of our surprise, at the end of the 2014 season, when the Vipers won the championship in the GT Pro class, they decided they were going to pull the plug on their program. And so after they pulled the plug on the program, Bill Riley came to me and said, listen, you know, if you've ever got an opportunity to go run at Le Mans, you need to go do it. At that point in time, I didn't really have a huge desire to go out and do it. And Bill just encouraged me to take advantage of that opportunity. And I still can't believe the way it all came together. But the fact is that, you know, Chrysler literally allowed me to borrow two of their cars, one as a car and one as a backup. I borrowed their cars and I put them in a boat and shipped them over there. And that's how I got into Le Mans. We DNF'd with an hour and a half to go, because, you know, we'd lost a gear in the transmission, and once you had metal in the transmission, even though we could replace gears pretty quickly, we kept on having failure pretty quickly. And we decided to stop trying to go through gear sets. But, you know, as you said at the beginning of the show, you know, this year was my 8th Le Mans in a row. This was the first year I've driven the same car twice. So my first 7 years were in 7 different cars. You know, 6 of my times I've been in a GTE car in the GT AM category, and 2 of those I was in an LMP2. In the LMP2 category, and all of the times that I have raced over the last 8 years, the structure has basically been, you know, the track layout and the structure of all the classes and everything has basically been the same, you know, as it will be next year in 2023 and beyond 2023, I think we're going to see a big bunch of changes. And, you know, right now, I think that's going to be a pretty good time for me to hang up my.
Well, that Aston Martin walks and talks for you.
it's been a very good car for that particular race. I think that particular car is it's the easiest car to drive at Le Mans that I've ever driven.
It shows. You're so smooth.
When you got a 24-hour race with 3 different drivers, having a car that's easy to drive is a big plus.
Yes. Neato. We'll be interested. So you don't think you'll do it in 23?
I will do it in 23 for sure, but it's the last year of the GTE class. And, you know, I love driving the GTE spec cars. I'm just not that interested in running a GT3 car, which is what they're going to switch to in 2024.
Well, you may have to rethink the cars. Okay. Neato.
Yeah, I'm gonna come.
You still got. You're a young man. You've got lots of energy left. Okay, who's next?
I got a question here for
Jeff Klein here.
Yeah, Jeff. So a guy in the audience wants to know about shortcut Jaguars. So tell us about the Jaguar Le Mans.
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting situation because Tony Dahl asked me to drive there about 6 weeks before the race, and I had been driving GTP cars, and I've been driving an IMSA since probably 1975 was my first IMSA race, but I always either did it free or got paid. And in 87, I had a good year with Spike, where we won six races, and I'd had 13 poles and 15 fastest laps. And Tony Dahl, for some reason, adopted me because I would never have probably seeked him out, you know. And then in 88, I drove with Bob Earl in a factory Spice Pontiac. And Tony was always friendly, and I had some good races with Davy Jones and Martin Brundle and those guys in the Jaguar. But we were kind of not very competitive because of the engines. Anyway, in 89, I'm driving with Costas Loos, and we're at, I think it was West Palm Beach, and I'm having a beer with my wife in the bar, and Tony Dahl comes over and sits down and asks me if I'd like to go to Le Mans with his team, and I was kind of flabbergasted because I never entered my mind. And anyway, I said, yeah, and he said, I'm really sorry. You know, I can only pay you X, and it was in the mid five figures, you know. And I thought, yeah, I can do it for that. I was kind of like dumbstruck. Anyway,
you didn't make him a counter
money,
offer, huh?
It was kind of like a whole lot of money. No, I should have, but I was like, I'd be glad to do it. So anyway, things progressed, and we had a race at Mid-Ohio the week before Le Mans, and wife went home, and I stayed there and tested the day on the Monday. And then we, with one, I forget the engineer's name, but we drove back to wherever their headquarters were in Indiana, Valparaiso, Indiana. And then we went to Chicago, got in a plane, and next thing we know, we're in, we fly in business class, and we're over in France, and go to the hotel. There's three driver suits, parkas, pants, shirts. Of course, they're all in purple. It was an interesting experience. And anyway, everyone was very nice. Unfortunately, I only got 11 laps in the car before the race started. And then the car broke after 4 hours, but we were doing 252 miles an hour down the Mulsanne.
Good grief.
The first time I did that, I thought, you know, if I die, I'm fine. But if I get maimed, I'm in bad shape. So I went and found John Gorsline, and I'm going to buy some disability insurance. And who's in front of me but Ari Leyendijk? He had the same thought I did, you know. But anyway, I drove with Derek Daly and Davy Jones, and the two really great guys. Derek was a wonderful, wonderful guy, really nice. Davy was a lot younger than I am. And probably the funniest thing that happened is I get a meeting with Waukesha. So I go in, and he's got my CV in front of him. And I don't know, can I swear on this podcast? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I quote
yourself.
But anyway, is that all right? So anyway, I sit down, and I go, you know, he shakes my hand, he makes some small talk, and he picks up my CV, and he goes, fuck me, you're older than I am. Because I was 45 by then, and it took me that long to get over there. And, you know, I was in good shape, but and he was a little bit overweight and stuff, but I think that was kind of sobering. He goes, you know, you're older than I am. Like, you know, what am I hiring you for? But anyway, it's kind of interesting. The car broke.
Talent. It's all about talent.
Price Cobb's car broke at this. Yeah. So Price Cobb's car broke at about the same time. And we've been palling around because we spoke the same language. And we've been palling around the whole week. And anyway, I looked at him and he looked at me and he said, let's go. So we got all our stuff, went to the hotel, checked out, and we were in Paris and checked into a hotel there. And, you know, then met everyone at the airplane on Monday. So that was the deal. It's kind of interesting.
Needless to say,
at least
after
he got to do something,
Waukesha,
but,
I realized,
you know,
how old I was. He didn't call me again.
Aw.
Yeah, I bought a beautiful Ebell watch for my wife, and, you know, so I was happy to do it. It was a real experience. One of the most sobering things is going down the Mulsanne at 250 plus, and one of the sobbers passed me. I was totally flat out, and the sobber just kind of creeped by me, maybe a mile an hour faster, and I thought that's the most amazing thing to get past when you're going that fast, you know.
Wow.
Anyway, that's my.
Well, that's a car that could have done it, though. Wow. Those things.
And,
well, you've got some good memories of it.
In fact, they won the year before and they won the year after. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's right.
And I made some good friends. Andy Wallace, I knew before. He was a great guy. And Andrew Gilbert Scott and Patrick Tombay and the
Thirteen Brothers.
They had, you know, first class drivers, and it was a real honor to be part of them, even for one race. So I enjoyed it. It's a great memory. And it's funny that when I meet people, if they know me, that's the thing that they remember me for. But it was, in terms of racing, probably the least significant race of my life, you know, in terms of results and so forth. So, but that's the way it is.
It's all about the place. Who's
anyway.
Next?
I got a question here for Bert Greenwood.
Yeah.
What was it like dealing with the French over there, trying to get an American car through tech with the American flag paint job and so on and so on?
That was overplayed in the sense that before we went in 72, the BFG point men kind of, you know, clearing the way for us and everything, told us not to wear the jackets with the American flags on them and stuff like that, because, you know, it was a couple time then there was a lot of stuff going on, like it is now, to a certain degree. And everybody loaded up with all their flag pants and everything we had. And we made sure we had our jackets on with the flags on everywhere we went. And we didn't run into any of those issues. Is that what you were interested in terms of whether we, it was like the, you know, the, as far as tech was concerned, I was dreading it and heard all the scary stories, and it turns out that it wasn't any worse than us going through Chicago region when we're not the most popular guys, you know, in an A production car. It's like the individual people working in tech had more to do with it, I felt like, you know, because we got a 32-gallon cell, 31.8, I think it was the FIA. But we put it in an aluminum container, knowing that would stretch, and it did. And I just took it, I took a gamble on what's that going to be. Everybody, I gave the girls an assignment. The girls, the timer women, and there was just some girls that came along with the race that weren't working at all, and they were just there. But they had the assignment. I asked them to buy milk containers, like in a liter, in a whatever they have, you know, different sizes. They brought them back. I tested them with gasoline. Anyway, our bottom line is I put it in the gas cell. As they go through, one of the things in Texas is you have to drain the cell completely, and then they fill it up in front of you. And, man, when it hit, I think it was, 120 liters? It just snapped off. The guy left. And he didn't bother squeezing it anymore, I think. But I had no way of knowing that going in, that that was going to work. In 73, there was no way they had a new figure eight because of the new section of the, what they call the, I've heard them called the Porsche curves or whatever, just before you come out on the front straightaway there, where you get those cutbacks. Our car, you've got to blip the throttle and bring the ass end around in order to go through those. And I knew that the car was required to steer through a course and try to make it intact. There's no way it's going to happen. So I asked the guy, can we push it through? If we have to drive it, there's no way the guy inside is going to be able to, you know, do this without destroying the clutch and everything else. And he said, yeah, you can push it. So I got everybody together, and we pushed it around this figure eight course. okay, crank it as hard as you can, And I got Joe Dvorak steering, and we're all pushing. And I'm kind of like the Cox Wayne guy or whatever the guy is, you know, okay, push. And everybody's lined up on one side of the car, and they're pushing it, and we literally slid the ass into the car and hung the car out without the engine on or going very fast. And we're able to get through the figure eight. But beyond that, we didn't. That's a big circuitous way of answering the fact that we didn't really experience any hard-nosed stuff. I think they appreciated that we were just kind of out there, hung out there, and that's kind of what they expect from Americans. So we gave it to them.
Okay. This is Trish.
We lost you for a minute there, Trish.
Yeah.
Yeah, my everything died on me here. Sorry about that, y'all.
Need a better phone. Rick knew. The guys were talking about Steve. You once told a story about your first experience going down the Mulsanne Street.
Hi. This is
me?
Rick Noop.
Or who?
And, this is Rick Noop. And hi, Trish. Hi, Dave.
Hey.
Hi, everybody. My beginnings and awareness of Le Mans was basically the Foyt, Gurney, and Americans at Le Mans, and I think it's rather apropos that we're all on here right now. Le Mans isn't really a race, it's the race. I've been told, and I've been lucky enough to run twice and podium twice. How I got started on all this is in 1974, Steve Earle started the Monterey Historic Car Races, which is coupled, as you know, with the Pebble Beach Concourse. And Steve Earle and my dad and Chris Cord and there was about 75 of us that year. That was the total enrollment or entry list. And we were kind of developing our skills as being road racers. My dad raced with Joe Huffaker and built a special. So I was always kind of infatuated, and being ranchers, I could operate most of the equipment around the ranch and stuff. So anyway, we'll fast forward at my first, I won a B sedan championship and an Alpha in 77. And then Steve Earle and Bob Aiken bought George Dyer's RSR. the preparation was done at Jim Busby Racing, and that started my 44-year association with Busby. 78 is my first year at Le Mans. I was running consistently in a Busby-prepared ex-George Dyer car with Bob Aiken, and we finished sixth overall. And Busby was driving with Hal Shaw in the 934. Two people came up. We were had sister pits there at the Rolex, and it was Manfred and Irwin Kramer. So Manfred and Irwin Kramer, the Kramer brothers from Cologne, Germany, goes up to Jim Busby and says, I like what's going on here. Do you, would you care to go to Le Mans? So Busby, after the race, pursued the conversation with the Kramer brothers. Chris Cord was involved with a startup company when the semiconductors. Amdahl underwrote the leasing of a 935. The long and short of it was I was 24 years old, and I missed graduation, college graduation. I was throwing the cap in the air, and there I am with no turbo time, but I'd driven a lot of McLaren Can-Am cars and vintage stuff, so I was sort of acclimated to power to weight or index of performance. And as long as you make good traffic decisions, the traffic management, and keep it on the asphalt. And I guess, Dave, I'll talk about my first go-around going down the Mulsanne. I've never been there with the chicanes, but I believe it ends up being 3.8 miles. And in a 935, you, I was kind of, they told me, Rick, have you any turbo time? And Busby says, does he have any turbo time? So he basically didn't answer the question. And I went out there and started kind of squeezing the throttle on, rolling it on, and went, wow. And with a four-speed and that and a crowned road, and you guys know all this, the cars can get a little nervous. But I came in after about three laps and open-face helmet. That's just kind of the way it was then. And my eyes were, my father obviously knows me quite well. He said, keep walking. And I said, all right. And it was, I've been in fast cars, but a sustained 190 to 200, what Jeff said, it's amazing to see people go by in the group six, not a mile and a half like his story. They were going by probably at 20 miles an hour from us. But I think the consistency, the concentration, and traffic management, you can, if you keep that in mind, you can do well there. Porsches were always known for reliability, and even though I was quite young, I ended up, I think we were sixth overall in group and first in group five, and then I was lucky enough to go back. Bert basically, Greenwood, you know, I appreciate him breaking in B.F. Goodrich back in 72, because then Busby and I have been sort of joined at the hip for 44 years now, and Buzz and I went back in 84 with a two-car effort with the Lola Mazdas, and we were first and third there. So is it a realistic view of Le Mans? I don't know. I've finished well both times. Those are sort of my first time when I was 24, and then 6 years later I went back, and I was third in Group C2. So pretty overwhelming, the carnival inside and, you know, the car clubs. I think it's been said they got close to 600,000 people for the week there, and I ended up getting quite a bit of notoriety just because, like us all on the phone right now, Americans at Le Mans is a pretty special place in my heart until the day I die. So that's a little bit of my experience.
Yeah, hey, Doc Bundy, how fast did you go at Le Mans?
This is Doc Bundy. Well, my first time there was in a Porsche 924 Turbo, and it was BF Goodrich shod. We qualified on BF Goodrich, which was the question mark. That was in 82, and we were part of a two-car effort, and I was paired with Jim Busby and Francois Mignot, a French guy. And for some reason, I think because it broke a motor in the night practice, our French driver only got a lap in, and even though he was the head instructor at the school there and knew every person at Le Mans by first name, and they wouldn't let him race, even though he'd had experience in much faster cars. And when the engine had broken in our car, Buzz got in the sister car. Back then you could switch cars, and he did his night practice in that car. So when it came Friday, when they put out the lineup, our car was eliminated, though it was quick enough to be in the field. And so Porsche and BF Goodrich got together and lobbied that, and they came down and they said, well, there's only one driver in it, and he can't do the whole race himself. And they said, no, Jim Busby's driving and with Doc. And so they had this big meeting, and they put us in, but they put us at the back of the field. They put us back into the race, and so we started dead last. And I think we ran the IMSA GTO category with this car. And we did pretty well. I didn't see much of Jim other than as he'd get out of the car, I'd get in. And so we made it through the night. And on Sunday, I think it must have been early afternoon, when Jim was in the car, we lost a head gasket. So they decided, well, we just got to keep going because we were leading our category. And that's what we did. We continued on to the finish. We took all the boost out of it, and we'd do two laps and come in and put bars leak in it and water and continued on. I remember early on Sunday we had not changed a tire at that point. And
wow.
They decided,
yeah,
incredible. And they decided to change a front tire because it had a slight little cut in the sidewall, though it wasn't leaking air. And when the engineers told the pit crew, change that tire, I said, why? No, keep it on there. At the pace we're running now, it should last forever, and you can claim 24 hours on one set of tires. But that wasn't their priority, so they took safety first and changed the one tire. But three of the tires were on the car the entire time. It was amazing.
Wow.
We were pretty slow at the end, and our main competitor at that point in the race was Billy Hagen with Terry Labonte, and I don't know who the third driver was, but they kept breaking gearboxes and having to rebuild the gearbox. So they'd catch up to us, and then they'd fall back behind fixing the gearbox. So it was an amazing experience, my first time there. And I drove in 82. We still were running on the full Mulsanne. There was no chicane. Then when I went back with Group 44 and Jaguar in 84, we still had the straightaway without the chicanes. And the big experience for that was obviously I was in a prototype, so I'm well over 200 mile an hour this time around. And I remember during the night it rained, and I was out there in the session, and I could barely see down the straightaway in the spray. And if those of you have driven the Le Mans with the straightaway intact, remember, yes, the road was crowned, so you had that to deal with water-wise, but also there was a turn in there, a very slight turn. And I remember I caught a car and moved over to the left to passing because he stayed on the right, and suddenly we were at that little bend in there, and I was flat out. And I said the quickest prayer I ever said in my life, and I promised the Lord if he would keep the car on the track, I would never pass anybody at that corner again. And yeah, I was scared. I was puckered up. And somehow it stayed on the track, and we went on. But we were battling the whole race. It was fun. We were battling the whole race. I co-drove with Brian Redman and Bob Tullius, and we were doing good. We were fighting third. Sometimes we would get second for a little while and then went back in third. And the Porsche guys kept coming down and looking at our fuel readout on our refueling system, because they were using a lot more fuel than we were, and they were worried about us, you know, in the latter stages of the race. But as it turned out, we also, during the night, we broke third gear in the gearbox, and when our mechanic repaired it, he evidently pinched an oil line, putting the box back together, and we ended up burning up the ring and pinion. And Sunday, when I don't know, I think it was after lunch sometime, we were still strong in the battle, and Brian brought it in, and when he got out of the car, he says, "Don't bother, Doc." I jumped in the car and belted myself in, and nobody was doing anything, and they said, we're going to retire it. And so I had a big argument with everybody, including Mr. Egan. They brought him down to talk me out of the car. It took him almost 2 hours to talk me to get out of the car, because I didn't want to quit. I kept telling him, I'm not a quitter, and I know that if we don't take the checkered flag, we're not considered, you know, we're,
yeah,
it's like you didn't even run Le Mans. And we had done so well, and I just didn't want to quit, you know. I didn't care where I finished. It's just kind of been how I am in racing. You know, I can stand not winning, but I want to finish the race always, no matter where. So eventually I realized that they wouldn't let the air jacks down, so I couldn't start up and drive away. So eventually I got up, got out. When I stood up in the seat to get out of the car, I didn't realize that there was a huge English contingent across the track from us in the grandstand, and they all stood up and applauded when I stepped out of the car. So it made me feel very strange, very strange. But it was a good experience. Then we just didn't get to finish. And then my final attempt there was with Panos, and I broke a night practice there, but I got enough laps in so we qualified. All three of us qualified, and I drove with David Brabham. I think it was Andy. I'm not sure, but I think it was Andy Wallace and David Brabham and I. And when I had broke in the night practice, I pulled off just where you enter onto the Mulsanne, and they push it behind the barrier, and I stayed there signing autographs and talking to all the campers for until the end of practice. And they come out and towed me back, and there was nobody in the pit when I got back. They had all gone off to dinner and left me.
Oh, good grief.
But we ended up breaking in that race.
That's all right. You're still doing what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a lot of...
Oh, by the way, they put the chicane in 1990. That was the first year.
Yeah. Yeah, when I went back with Pano,
I was wondering.
We ran with the chicane. Yes, but the odd thing
of
that
1990
whole,
was the first year. Yeah,
the whole time sitting over there with the car and all the spectators was that they brought probably I don't know 12 year old. Girl over that could speak English, so she would interpret all their questions and everything, and then I would tell her in English, and she would convert it to French. So, and the whole couple hours I was there went by, you know, rather quickly, and it was they loved the sound of that Panos with that big V8 in it. That was their big thing. They loved the sound of that car. So my experience was wonderful the first time and frustrating the next two times.
And a question here from the audience, Ben Keaton. How fast did you go with the chicane in place? What was the top speed you saw there?
So, I mean, I guess it depends on what car you're driving, but in the LMP2 that I ran in 2016 and 17, we would get up, you know, just barely, you'd reach 200 miles an hour, and in the GT car, we would get up to right around 190. Usually at the start of the race when you have, you know, a big old long line of cars and you got a big tow from a bunch of people in front of you, you can go a little quicker than you can when you are by yourself. And, we'll get up to right around 190 in the GT car. You know, I want to comment real quickly about, you know, the experience that Mr. Greenwood had there in the American Corvette. I won the race in 2019 in as the only privateer effort that ever ran in the new Ford GT. And on Monday morning, we were disqualified because of having too much fuel capacity. We were over our limit by 400 milliliters or 4/10 of a liter. And,
I remember
everybody always assumed, everybody always assumed that it was the, the French trying to get the Americans, I had Bill Ford, you know, with Ford Motor Company wanting to pick a fight with them, but, I never really felt that way. You know, clearly our fuel bladder had expanded during the race. The rules were out there before the race. And if they were out to get us, then we just made it too damn easy for them. You know, they checked it three different times and it was over every single time. you know, we didn't win because of that, and we weren't trying to cheat. You know, we were burning 6.5 liters per lap. That wouldn't have gotten us to the Dunlop Bridge. And, but, you know, we still feel like, you know, after they took the trophies away from us, I called the trophy shop in Le Mans, and I ordered new trophies for everybody. Because we all know who won that race. So,
yeah.
Yes.
I bled for you after that. I was rooting you guys on, and you did an outrageous job at the end of that race. And it's just like, it was so disappointing. And I thought,
well,
you guys handled it the way we would have, which is, you know, we don't get excited. We don't, you know, stuff
happens. Yeah, it was nice to win.
But it was never that tight. When we were racing, it wasn't even close.
Yeah, it was nice to win it again this year and be able to keep it.
Yeah.
I was jumping up and down again on that one. Okay, I got to do a station identification break. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website and up www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify podcasts, now reaching millions of fans. Download the apps and listen on your phone, your car radio, or your computer. Ta-da! Okay. Are we all happy? Okay.
Hang on. I didn't do my fun story. It's the only thing I got going for me. Unlike all you other gentlemen, this is Burke. Burke Greenwood. I've watched all you guys and rooted for all of you to a man. I thought every time an American was in a car like you guys were in, I was rooting for you. And I have just a tremendous amount of respect for everything you guys have done. The only thing I told Trish when she invited me, she was kind enough to invite me to this group. I told her, these guys have all done something, you know. The only thing I can say is my experience is more like George Plimpton and the Detroit Lions, you know, where you get a writer or somebody that's from the outside and pop them in something. Because like Doc was saying, he had that Francois Miguel as a co-driver. That guy in 1976 is the only time I drove. And the rest of the time, I was like the warrior in chief, I suppose. But I had gotten my way into being a co-driver with my brother and Bernard Darniche in the 76 car. And that was Rick Mancuso's Greenwood wide body that we had built for him. And I really was far less qualified than any of you gentlemen. And it took Bertie Martin, John talking to Bertie Martin, and Bertie Martin writing off, but I get a professional license out of this deal. I'm thinking, there is no justice. If we call Ben Keating an amateur, and I got a professional FIA license. I mean, I'd driven Formula V, a couple of Yanko Stingers that Don lent to me for school, and I had driven in the 75 Sebring and the 76 Sebring. But other than that, nothing. And it was just something.
It makes you the bravest one of us all.
Stupid. Because John wasn't happy with
brave.
It. He understood now, you know. But I was doing the
if not now, when? You know, and I'm 20 something stupid, and everybody was talking about the kink. This is, you know, the non-chicane variety. And before I went out, I asked John, are you going through the kink flat? He said, yeah. And so I spent the first two laps. First lap, I thought that was the end of the damn straightaway. I thought, well, that kink's nothing. Because when I'm coming up on the kink, when you're going 200 plus, it looks like it's a right-hand turn because you're seeing nothing but trees across the horizon. It is really quite, I tell you what, it got my attention. And the second lap, I was going to go through it flat.
We were taking it.
I thought I was going through flat.
We were taking that flat at 250 miles an hour.
That's crazy, man. I mean, I wonder what the difference is in the prototypes that you guys. I always wanted to get John in the prototype, man. I thought he'd love that stuff. He liked that Lola T260. He used that for all it was worth the one time he drove it. But I can't imagine because in the Corvette it was. It's sort of like a four-wheel. We call it a four-wheel drift, but it's more of an explosion when it happens. So it's like it doesn't last long enough to really fix on what the hell it was. All I know is where I entered was right on the, you know, John told me, man, when you hit, I think it was the three, he says, when you hit the three, and he makes a motion in front of me with his hands. He says, turn it then. And he said, just give it a kick. And my God, it was, I went through it and ended up raising a wall of dust because I was overhanging the outside in the dirt. And if I put the whole tire off in the dirt, I ain't catching it. And I was a little late. So the third lap, I went in where I was supposed to. I wasn't going to leave the dance in that dance. You know, I wasn't going to not leave that place and not have that chance because I had a feeling, you know, I may not be back here again, which was indeed the case. Because I never even got a chance to drive in the race. So I come here with outrageous respect for you gentlemen that have gone more than five or six laps, you know. I'm not sure which it was. I think there's six laps worth of stories, so I'd have to check that out. But they're all pretty vivid. And it was
in the six,
221. But I think we were
all
over
the same thing. I asked the same question.
I think it was 221 is what the track
was. I was just going to say in the Jag.
They're quite accurate. But somebody else got us at 230.
Forget it.
But we were pretty dirty air-wise. We had cornering lamps on the and the wider package and everything. But it, yeah. It was later on, that years later, talking about this thing with John stuff, and I said, man, I'm glad you were telling me the truth about going through the kink flat and stuff. He said, I didn't mean for you to do it. He said, you got to build up to this, for Christ's sakes. You ask John a question, man, you get a literal ass answer. And I told him, well, I'm glad you weren't exaggerating nothing, man.
I got another question here from the audience. We had, by the way, a while back, we had Derek Bell, Redman, and John Fitzpatrick talking about, among other things, Le Mans. The audience wants to know what it was like driving there in the rain. I don't know who raced in the rain and who didn't, but you kind of go around in order and tell us about driving there in the rain.
Yeah. That leaves me out.
Oh, we had rain.
I couldn't understand what you were saying there.
It
wasn't very loud.
What was it like driving in the rain?
I'm sorry?
So the comment, this is Ben Keating.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. This is Ben Keating. Yeah,
yes.
The question was, what was it like for any of us to drive in the rain? And, I don't know how many of you watched that Audi documentary called Truth in 24, but I always laugh about the very first line of that whole movie is Jason Statham, who narrates it, and he says, "It always rains in Le Mans." I go into the race knowing that that's kind of the standard, that it usually rains there. It's obviously, it's a little bit more hairy when you have, four different classes and you're in the slowest class. So you've got all these other cars coming around you, especially in the era when we had the LMP1s that were basically all-wheel drive with the electric motors up front. But basically everybody else in the race could do stuff that we couldn't do. It never really rained hard enough that I felt like it was, super dangerous. I think the crown in the road helped. There was always, you are always taking a big risk, but as racing in the rain goes, the course drained pretty well. The hairiest part for me was always, trying not to get hit, when other cars were passing you and taking a little bit more risk to try to get around you. I was just always trying to drive, with a little, force field protection, shield around my car to make sure that somebody else in a faster car didn't take us out. I'm sure I wasn't the fastest that way, but I'm trying to make it to the end.
Anybody else getting wet?
As a guy, I'm asking you gentlemen because you guys have, hundreds of laps. As few as I did, which is just out, it's like top gear territory stuff. It seemed like it wasn't a physical track in particular. And I didn't ever really, I actually felt more uncomfortable with that, with the way things had developed on, it came as news to me. This is a time where we're not doing any computer game simulation stuff here, and the track map never really gives you a feeling for much of anything. So as few laps as I had, by the fifth lap, I don't even know the whole new section yet. But I pretty much was getting a handle on all the way through Arnage area. And that the right-hand kick that approaches Indianapolis, that kick to the right, made me the most nervous because it's like, hey, man, I'm going every bit as fast as I go on the Mall sign within, 10, 20 miles an hour maybe. And the way traffic could start developing, it felt like, man, there's not a lot of lying through here. There's not a lot of two-way things going to happen through here. The kink is, I can't imagine Doc going through there with somebody. That's outrageous. But to me that the coming into there, there isn't a lot of braking going on. You're moving right along, and it's a whole bunch of your lap. I felt is right there, and I don't know that for a fact. I was just asking, and it's not a observation. It's just a question. I've seen so many accidents develop right there with regard to traffic, because our car, once I got up to speed, there wasn't any getting passed by anything. We were the fastest on the straightaway, that M76. And so we're coming up on people, and it's always a question, is this guy looking in his mirror? And if they're not using their turn signal, which I was thought, wow, yeah, I'd do that over these states, man. I like that. Because the guys that would use that would give you the, okay, this guy knows I'm coming. But, that was where I could see something bad happening, possibly. I loved Indianapolis. That was fun. John liked it, too, when he told me how to drive that. He says, yeah, just put the nose in the bottom and just get on a throttle. And he does the hand motion of coming out of there. It's all four wheel, just whoop, right up to the top of the track. It was cool out of that. I loved that. But what was the I know you guys are in the prototype. You guys are dealing with traffic everywhere, and to get through that the way you gentlemen have and proving yourselves. Time and time again, and I watch you guys all through the damn night, and I've been in your cars with you, and just enormously impressed, at the level of drivers that are out there now. It's just incredible, and you guys started it, I feel. Yeah.
Actually, we got another question about traffic. Maybe, let's start with Jeff Klein. How did you deal with traffic going 250 miles an hour?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry.
Jeff, are you ready?
I think they're all pretty good.
He's having a snack.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yep.
You can hear me?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Anyway, people stay, they stay to the right going down the Mulsanne, and then, you have to time it so when you go through the kink flat out at 250 miles an hour, you don't come up on somebody on the exit. So it's like anything else. It's a matter of timing. And those cars are not that easy to drive because they would use locked rear ends, which made it really awful in the turn-in. And then additionally, they would bleed off most of the downforce. So normally the Jag at, say, Daytona was making 7,000 pounds of downforce, and at Le Mans it was only making 2,000 pounds of downforce.
Wow.
So all the fast stuff was a little bit scary. But I asked Price Cobb, is the kink flat? And he said, the kink is flat. So the first lap, they had this kind of telemetry on the car, and I thought, I can't be a pussy here. So the first lap out at speed, I said, I give my faith in Price. So once you got through it, then you were through it, and you knew you could do it. But I figured, I'd take him at his word. He was right, and it was a little bit scary, but the traffic isn't really that bad. Same at Daytona. I'm sure all of us have run Daytona. You just get used to the rhythm of who you can trust and who you can't. You identify them, and you just give a little extra space. And then once the race started, it was just a matter of trying to be there at the end. Don't do something stupid,
Yeah.
That's my philosophy anyway. It hasn't really served me in most of my life, but I try not to do stupid things in the race car. I try and just do them out of the race car.
How about you, Doc Grundy? How about traffic?
Traffic, well, with the 924 turbo that first year, I wasn't doing a whole lot of passing. But we did have a good pace. I was trying to remember, I don't, in all the cars that I drove there, I don't, I guess I never asked what the top speed was. So I have no clue. I just know I could pass some guys I couldn't pass. But traffic was, that's a big thing there, especially when you're, you know, you don't have a lot on the other guy. So you just got to, like Jeff said, just you got to look at the big picture, you know, should I, could I squeeze in there before, to get clean through the corner before he turns down? So, you know, you just have to calculate that out and then keep in mind the big picture of what you're trying to accomplish there. And I must say that unlike a lot of races that aren't a Le Mans or a 24 hours of Daytona or even a 12 hours of Sebring, you kind of, you're a bit more aggressive. And working your way through traffic is can be really fun, and it all depends. It comes down to if the car is set up correctly and you're comfortable in it, and you know, you get your confidence from what the car can do. I enjoy passing. That's one of the thrills. you know, like. I remember that in those first couple years that I went over there, going down what we call the Mulsanne, it was like those of you that have lived over here on the East Coast and driven down to Florida on a rainy day a few years back, the road was used so much it had grooves in it on the interstate 75. It would have grooves in it where the cars ran, and those grooves in the rain, if it was a hard rain, would fill up with water. Well, Le Mans was like that those early years, and you could feel when you track out of those, or if you were in it, there was times if you like stepped in real hard, you could spin in top gear, you could spin the tires. So remember I told you about the little prayer I said? Well, it was one of those situations, you know, you kind of had to cross over those little flooded areas in the night, in the rain, and you wanted that whole, you wanted the whole road for yourself. And I don't know how I made it through that corner, but I was lucky. But I made sure that, like Jeff said, I knew exactly where I was from that point on. I really concentrated on okay, I'm going to catch him at the kink, or I'll just ease up a little bit and take him on the exit of the kink. So it's racecraft. It's just learning your racecraft. And it was, it would sure pucker you up, I can tell you that. And I think every year I ever went to Le Mans, so only a few times, we did have rain at some point. So you get to experience the track in the wet, so you have some idea. And it's a challenge. It becomes more of a challenge in the wet, certainly, than it is to drive in the dry. I'd like to tell one little story, and I'll keep my mouth shut after that. But back when I ran, back when I ran in '82 in the 924, my best friend, my mentor, Al Holbert, was running in for Porsche in the prototypes. And So we talk all the time about everything. And on a Saturday, sunny day, and I'd exit Arnage, and right when you come out of Arnage, you're going towards the Porsche curves, there was a little side road off to the right that went over into the woods on the right, I guess towards a village. And I remember I come out, and that's right where you would, for me and the cars that I was driving, it was right where you shifted into third, I think, yes. And I glanced over to the right, and here's a guy standing on that road, that little road, right at the edge of the trees, and in a bikini. He would give me the finger, and I thought
that was Rick Newton.
Well, no, this guy was not. This guy
it looked
not,
like one of our crew.
He was a bit overweight in this little bikini, and so I thought, did I really see that? So of course I thought about it the whole lap around till I come back around, and I looked over, and there he was, and he gave me the finger again, and I thought, oh, what the hell is it? Why is he giving me the finger? And so this happened Saturday, then again on Sunday he was back and doing the same thing again. So I never said anything to Buzz because we just never got to talk that much. But when I got back to the States, I was talking to Al, and I said, Al, I saw something I can't really understand. And he says, what was that? And so I told him, the exit of Arnage. And before I finished what I was saying, he says, that guy standing over there in the bikini giving you the did he give you the finger? I said, yeah. And I said, I can't understand. How did he know, did he hate Americans or everybody? And evidently, after Al acknowledged, yeah, he got the finger too, I didn't feel so bad. I know that's a bit off of racing, and I apologize for that.
It's a memory
that I can't get out of my head since the 80s.
Oh, that's funny.
Sorry about
hey,
that.
Hey, Rick New, how about you and traffic in the rain and stuff?
Well, I didn't have any rain the first year. That was 78, and I guess that was pretty unusual. I will comment about 84 because I remember Doc was talking about we were pitted pretty close to Tullius and the 44 guys and some of the transmission problems they were having. But I've got a fast little story that isn't rain related, but which has got some goosebumps to it. In 84, I was about 40% going, about halfway down the Mulsanne, and the car started to shudder, and I thought, holy crap. And I was in a Lola 616 with a Mazda motor in it. So I think we were going about 178, 183 or something. So we weren't clearly the fastest, but we weren't the slowest. And it was dry, and I thought, oh, my God. We were right lane material, and so I sort of did, for some of you pilots out there, a dead stick landing. I didn't want to have anything to do with being on the Mulsanne, especially that far into the Mulsanne. So I had parked to the side, put the emergency lights on, and we got some tainted fuel, or whether it was water in it or whether it was some debris. But that's not the time or place to be stuck at a place called Lamont, especially the straightaway then. And I guess I'll include the kink as being the straightaway, but it was close to 4 miles in length. And that, to me, I think you can adjust to the rhythm there, the occasional traffic you get, but to be static or stationary and watching and hearing the induction and the almost the wake turbulence going by, I think when it's all said and done, I couldn't have been more honored to be there, to be an American at Le Mans, but to be stationary on the Mulsanne was, we got some communication, and I've forgotten what the rules were then, but you've got to be a little careful who works on the car, but we ended up putting it into one of the taller gears. It was a 5-speed Hewland, put it into fifth gear and rocked it backwards, and I guess just luck of the draw, whatever was impeding the flow was dislodged, and off I went again. Then to get back on the original question with the on the rain, yeah, I've hit rain pretty substantially, but I think we can all kind of agree with this. When you're running tunnels and at speed makes downforce and low pressure, and you get almost like a burning little hydroplane sort of exit, and the visibility is pretty god awful. You got to run kind of staggered, as you guys know, like the Blue Angel. If you were to run tandem or in the 12 and 6 o'clock position, you can't see anything, but that's just part of the newer sort of air management. I think we were all agreeing it's a rather exaggerated crown there, and that works to, I think, all of our benefits, because the water does drain on both sides, but it makes for a nervous race car when you're staggering, climbing up and down the crown of it. But I think in anything else in racing, I've driven a lot of different categories, cars, GTU, GTO, and GTP, and I think as long as your concentration and you're dealing with the massive effort it takes just to run the States, let alone containers and manifests and all that to get to Europe, you've got quite a bit of responsibility on your shoulders. I think we've all earned it to go there. But it's Busby's the one that I came up with that quote. He said, it's not a race, it's really the race for us road racers. And there's a lot to be said that we all went there and we're in one piece. A lot of guys didn't come back from that place in one piece. The numbers that Jeff Klein was talking about, it's all sort of, it's an unbelievable place, and I congratulate all of us for getting the opportunity and staying in one piece, but do you adjust there? Hell yeah, you do. But you've got an awful lot of people. It isn't just a jack stand and a 5-gallon drum of fuel. You want to come back with the sort of results each and every one of us have done. I'm pretty hard on myself on things like that, and I think that's why I demand a lot. And most times I've been able to enjoy some success. If you don't keep your concentration smooth, consistency and concentration there, you can get in a world of hurt. So those are some of my thoughts.
Okay, Trish, let's wrap this up.
You sure? Are you not having enough fun?
Oh, yeah, we've been an hour and a half. Good show.
It has been a good show. Well, anybody got anything they want to say at the end here?
Well, thanks, I just Brad. Want to thank
you. I just want to say how much I admire Ben Keating.
Oh, yes, I do too.
Yeah, we're real proud of him.
I admire all you guys.
I think it's amazing that he's done such a great job, and I'm really impressed with his ability. And very, I think I told this to him on Facebook, but very rarely do you get somebody that has the resources and the talent and does really well with both. And so you have my admiration.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, agree.
Me too.
And you've all, every one of you guys has impressed me that same way at one time or another. And as far as me not, this is for, and I just want to say, as far as me not having a lot of experience on the track, I wasn't going to put myself in any compromising position where it endangers anybody else. And never felt like I was out of shape or anything. I did well and would have done well. And that's the way you have to feel about it before you do that kind of thing, I suppose.
Yep.
Well, I've had a good time. I have been looking forward to this one.
Always.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. It was good to hear from you, Doc.
Yeah, same here, Bert.
Yeah, you got great stories, buddy. And I apologize for all the smart ass shit I did to you and Jack and Mike.
Hey, Bert, I'm still doing it. I'm still doing it. It's hard for me to understand. It's hard for me to understand that I'm still being paid to drive a race car and having the time of my life, but I am.
Maybe we can do a Thelma and Louise kind of thing or something.
Only you guys have been terrific. This will be a popular show. Go ahead, Trish.
Okay. I thank everybody for joining us tonight. It's got a fascinating crowd. It's got all the best people. Now, next month, hello, somebody's got noise. Okay, our next show next month, a lot of static here. Can you hear me?
Yes,
yeah,
I can hear you.
Hello?
Check.
Okay, all I could hear was noise. Our next show next month will be on August 17th. And it'll revolve around the first of a series about the different tracks that we all know and love. And the first one will be Road Atlanta. And I'm getting the panel together now. And so far, we've got Earl Walker, Randy Lanier, Don Whittington, and I've got some drivers I've got in mind. And Janet Upchurch. So we're working on getting a really good crowd to that one. And Road Atlanta is a favorite for some people, and I hope a lot of people. It's my home track, and I'm very, very attached to that place. And so that's what we're looking at for next month. In the meantime, everybody, enjoy your evening. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we will go end this thing tonight, and with great enthusiasm for seeing Ben's next go round at Le Mans, and as usual, watching him on every track that he's at. I have thoroughly enjoyed tonight.